so hot right now. You better not.
To SER's Arts and Culture Show.
Don't make me say so hot right now.
Your weekly dose of arts and culture.
And all of that sort of stuff.
It's that weird thing that they're classics because they're classics because they're classics, and then they become the classics and everyone wants to do the classics because they're classics.
He's amazing.
Well, you need a lot of room for all that blood.
And he's hot as a firecracker.
You're listening to So Hot Right Now. You better not use me saying that.
Amazing babes.
On 2SER 107.3.
Good morning and welcome to So Hot Right Now on 2SER. It is the first show for 2019, and that means we have to say goodbye to our lovely host Sophie, who after I think about 4 years at the station was just about done with her 6-day working week. But that means I am taking over, and my name is Nicole Beck, and I'm here to present you an absolutely jam-packed show. As many of you know, Sydney Festival is about to start on the 9th of January, so we are unpacking a bunch of shows on the program, as there are a lot of amazing things happening in Sydney in the coming months. So we're talking about we're talking to the director of La Passion de Simon, Amara Savage. This is a spiritual modern opera that explores the life of French philosopher, political activist, and mystique Simone Weil. Then you'll hear all about The Beehive, which, not too dissimilar from La Passion de Simon, also explores the life and legacy of an amazing woman in history. But this one is from Sydney, and her name is Juanita Nielsen, which might ring a bell for a few of you. I was lucky enough to chat to Zanny Beck ahead of the exhibition's opening today, and she's created this amazing multimedia installation featuring a stunning experimental documentary that is honestly just incredibly exciting. You should all check it out. And later on, I'll be joined by Daniel Browning to discuss the return of Black Box, which in its second iteration is heading out to Blacktown, which is also part of Sydney Festival. And it's grown a lot since we spoke about it last year. It was in Barangaroo. And so we're excited to welcome Daniel back to the show again in 2019. And then last on the agenda, we'll be unpacking Masters of Modern Sound. This is a really exciting work hitting the Art Gallery of New South Wales. It's an after-dark experience of art, space, and sound. There's heaps to look forward to there, and there's a lot of artists on the bill. We're going to be speaking to the executive producer and one of the artists, Chris Abrams, who is a pianist. And they're going to come into studio later today. So as you can see, we've got a huge hour ahead of us today. I'm going to kick it off with a bit of music. A language warning on this one. This is No Name with Regal. You're tuned into 2SER.
Fist I haven't. May the Lord be with me. Made me look like reverend. Made me look like regal. South side abandoned. I swear I look so regal. I swear I look so regal. Made my wrong turn right. Made my fist I haven't. May the Lord be with me. Made me look like reverend. Made me look like regal. South side abandoned. I swear I look so regal. I swear I look so regal.
Oh, my baby got to know me. I'm looking like I'm the homie. I'm tatted from head to shoulder. I'm colder when he don't hold me. I'm warmer inside the casket. Basket atop my head. Africa's never dead. Africa's always dying. No more apples and oranges, only pickles and pacifists. Twitter ranter from martyrdom, unified as capitalists. Give him death, be gone. Give him Teflon done. Give him rice around the politics to bear my arms and watch the bears come out. Yeah. Make my wrong turn right. Make my fist turn heaven. May the Lord be with me. Made me look like reverend, made me look like regal. South side abandoned, I swear I look so regal. I swear I look so regal. Made my wrong turn right, made my fist turn heaven. May the Lord be with me, made me look like reverend, made me look like regal. South side abandoned, I swear I look so regal. I swear I look so regal. Thank you.
Good morning and welcome back to So Hot Right Now on 2SCR 107.3. That there was a track from No Name, Regal. And right now we're going to jump straight into the content as we've got a very busy, busy show for you. So we are talking all about Sydney Festival. As we all know, it's right around the corner. And this year we're going to be kicking it off, our show, in terms of Sydney Festival, with La Passion de Simone. This is a spiritual modern opera detailing the life of Simone Weil. Simone Weil was born around the turn of the 19th century and throughout most of her life was seen as crazy for fighting for what she believed in. Today we remember her, her life, and as a philosopher, activist and mystic who fought for truth and justice in La Passion de Simone as a part of Sydney Festival. Director Amara Savage is on the line now to talk about Simone and the show. Good morning, Amara.
Morning. How are you going?
Well, thank you. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Thanks so much for talking to us on your Saturday morning.
That's all right. We're right in the middle of tech at the moment.
So. Oh, wonderful. So La Passion de Simone details the life of Simone Weil. Can you just talk us through her philosophy and her activism?
So Simone Weil was a French philosopher, and from a very, very early age, I think from around the age of 6 or 7 or 8 or something, she was kind of inclined to political activism and had a deep sense of kind of social justice and empathy. And she demonstrated that kind of independently to her family, who were kind of free-thinking leftists as well. But she decided that, as in an act of solidarity with the soldiers who were fighting on the front, that she would ration her intake of food and sugar in particular. You know, so she was, it's quite extraordinary for a child to be kind of making political statements at such an early age. And from there, she just, she's known as you said, a philosopher, a mystic, a political activist. I think one kind of article described her as a performative philosopher, and I think that's very true. Like, a lot of her ideas were around empathy and compassion, as I said, and in her life, she put herself in kind of extreme situations to understand ideas around suffering. So she, you know, even though she was from a somewhat kind of middle class family, she decided she would go and work with the working class in factories. And she spent, you know, a period of time doing that. She went and worked on farms because she really wanted to understand the plight of the workers. And so, yeah, it's very hard to encapsulate what who she is and what she did. She's, she's a really multifaceted, kind of interesting individual.
Yeah, it sounds like she did a whole range of things that made her who she was and why she's famous.
Oh, I think partly it's a contradiction. You know, she was a pacifist and a mystic, but at the same time, you know, she fought for the French resistance and, she was kind of interested in Trotsky, but then she decided that, you know, she was very anti-political parties and that all political parties should be abolished. She had kind of extreme ideas and often they were contradictory and, you know, yeah.
So the show is described as a spiritual opera, spiritual contemporary opera. What do you mean by spiritual? Is that a note to her mysticism or...?
I think sometimes it's described as an oratorio, although the composer, Kaija Saariaho, I think she doesn't like it to be described like that, but an oratorio traditionally is, you know, a kind of a requiem for dead. And so it is about the life of, I suppose in a way, you could say the librettist views her as a kind of a martyr or a saint in the same way that Jesus is viewed as a martyr and a saint. And this is somebody who lived her life in a very deeply spiritual way, in order to try to understand the plight of human suffering and the kind of point of existence. And so the music and the libretto are kind of doing different things in a way. The libretto is telling, in some ways, a semi-straightforward narrative about some of the interesting things she did in her life. And also within that, it's interspersed with sections of her philosophy, which can be quite oblique at times, you know. But at the same time, the music is operating on a very different plane. And Kaija Saariaho, the composer, said what she was really interested in is Weil's philosophies around mathematics and her kind of spiritual ideals. So Faye came from a very mathematical family. Her brother was a famous mathematician, and she was interested in physics and ideas around light and gravity. She wrote a book called Gravity and Grace, and Sarriaho was very interested in that book and trying to encapsulate that in music. So it's a piece that holds this tension of between light and gravity, and gravity being the weight of what it is to be human and to suffer, and light being the other side of that kind of transcendence and being able to evolve into more spiritual, compassionate human beings.
Wonderful. I've read that this opera also incorporates, as well as soprano, choir and orchestra, electronic elements. Can you explain the nexus between those two elements?
That was the full score. So this is the chamber version, which is without electronic elements. I mean, it is, it's amplified, but it's not, it doesn't have the electronic elements that she had for the full score. This is a smaller, reduced chamber version, which is for 20. And it has a group of four singers plus the soprano. I mean, the thing with this piece, in a way, that the designer, Elizabeth Gadsby, and we're working with a filmmaker, a video artist called Mike Daly. And I suppose in some ways the way that we've approached the piece is more like if you're familiar with the works of Bill Viola or even Marina Abramovic, more like an opera art installation video work. So it's really kind of testing what the form can be, I suppose, but we felt like that was the most appropriate way to represent this piece, having kind of looked at the libretto and the music in quite a lot of detail.
Can you explain, you mentioned there was the presence of video art. What might that look like?
Well, it's, you know, as I was saying, like Bill Viola's work is kind of a good reference point. We also looked at people like Anna Mandieta, who does not video work, but almost sometimes she videos for installation art. We looked at her work as well. Really, the piece, as I said, is kind of like influenced by this book, Gravity and Grace, and the pull between gravity and light. And also it deals with ideas around metaphysics and physics and existentialism. And so we, you know, there's a sense with her music that it's constantly in a state of flux and constantly in a state of evolution. And that's quite hard to do in theatre and lends itself more to the medium of film. So I think originally in a lot of her work, Sarriaho was influenced by kind of white noise. And as you said, electronics, even though they're not a part of this piece, she was very interested in kind of electronics. And so we were kind of looking at, I was looking at white noise. I was looking at endurance artwork, endurance video pieces, ideas around pain and suffering and ideas around compassion. And, yeah, it just led us to the medium of film. In particular, we were looking a bit at Bill Viola's Martyrs series, which is a really beautiful series of video works.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. Sadly, that's about all we have time for, but it sounds like a wonderful work.
Oh, great. Well, thank you for having me.
No problem. That was Amara from Mara Savage, who is directing Le Passion de Simone, which tells the story and philosophy of political activist Simone Weil. Sounds like a wonderful nexus between both art, metaphysics, science, math. Yeah, sounds absolutely incredible. That's showing at Carriage Works from the 9th to the 11th, and you can get tickets via carriageworks.com.au, and we will put all the details to that up on our show page. Just search for So Hot Right Now on the 2SER website. I'm going to take another track now. This is Steady from The Staves. You're tuned into So Hot Right Now.
Steady, steady, steady. Your steady touch I love so much, I'm sleepless. Oh God, oh God, oh God. God, I'm only human and I'm helpless. Steady, steady, steady. Your steady touch I love so much, I'm sleepless.
Happy New Year. I'm Craig Donarski, Director of Casula Powerhouse Art Centre in Liverpool, and we're rested and refreshed and ready to rock into 2019. We're kicking off with an amazing Sydney festival show called Suppression Dam on the 12th and the 13th of January. Ensemble Offspring join New York's International Contemporary Ensemble and Ensemble Adapter from Berlin for an amazing surround sound concert in our Turbine Hall. They'll be playing The Dam by Kate Moore and Cleave by Natasha Anderson after an amazing warm-up by Alice Chance's The Audience Choir. You can book a ticket and meal package, which also includes a glass of wine for only $70 or $50 concession. See this and lots more at CasulaPowerhouse.com.
Good morning and welcome back to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of arts and culture. This morning we are doing a whole big hour on Sydney Festival. And now we're going to kick off with our next big thing, which is one of my favourites, one of the best things I've seen in a while, actually, the Beehive. So Juanita Nielsen was a journalist, style icon and activist. And in 1975, she went missing, never to be seen again. And Zanny Beg explores this in her new work, The Beehive, which incorporates film, drawing, installation to explore this multifaceted life. The multifaceted life of Juanita Nielsen. For those of you who, like me, have never heard of Juanita, she was famous for campaigning against the violent eviction of tenants on Victoria Street, King's Cross, supporting people who were being pushed out to make way for apartment blocks. She disappeared in 1975, and it's been more than 40 years, and her body has never been found, and no one has ever been charged for her murder. There's been two films made about this, and in both of the films, Juanita, her name was not mentioned. So it's a whole big Sydney mystery, and it was about time that someone opened up the case again and explored it from a new perspective, and this is exactly what Zanny Beg did, and I was lucky enough to speak to her ahead of the exhibition's opening. What inspired you to explore Juanita Nielsen's story?
So living in Sydney, I feel like Juanita Nielsen's ghost really hovers over the city. It's hard to really forget her story because there's such a mystery around what happened to her. And personally, in my own work, I've been really interested in how cities function, issues like gentrification, issues like urban diversity. I myself have moved from inner city Redfern out to live in Fairfield for a few years, and now I live down near Wollongong. So I feel like, in a way, Juanita is like a patron saint of the city. She really cared about low-cost housing in the inner city. She really cared about the diversity of the community in King's Cross. So all those things made me really want to find out more about her story.
Did anything about the time that we're living in particularly inspire you? Like, why now?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question because it was, over 40 years ago that Juanita actually vanished. I would say that it's become only more relevant. The issues that she addressed back then have actually only become more pronounced in recent times. So Sydney is now one of the 10th least affordable cities in the world. And I think Juanita saw that dynamic already playing out when what was happening in the 1970s was you had all the beautiful old buildings in Sydney were being eyed off by developers, and they really had one goal, which was the bottom line. They wanted to sell, homogenise the urban experience around a certain sort of affluent set. And that meant that buildings that had multiple uses and mixed communities living in them would be knocked down or would be renovated and transformed and beyond recognition to house a much more homogenous set of people. And I'd say back in the 70s, a lot of that community that used to live in Kings got pushed out to Western Sydney. And what Juanita was concerned about was things like public transport and social services and opportunities didn't follow them. So what you create is sort of social isolation, and you create a dislocated city where you have the kind of the haves and the have-nots and the wealth bubbles and the poverty ghettos. I think that today we live in a city that has been marked by 40 years of not dealing with that, and the fact that we never tried anyone for Juanita's murder, her killers were never caught, the developers made the money. I think all those factors mean that we have to really come to grips with this story if we're going to turn around what I see as a deleterious direction for Sydney to be taking.
Speaking about the areas that she was trying to protect. Central to both the photographs and the film work in Beehive is the 202 Victoria Street. I want to know what's there now.
So it was so amazing. That was Juanita's house in the late 1960s, early 1970s. She bought it for around about $10,000, which would be hard to imagine now how much it would actually cost. But it's really tiny. It's just over 3 metres wide. But the man who actually owns it now is a supporter of Juanita. So I approached him and I said, would it be possible to film there? And he said yes, which was incredible. And it was really poignant and beautiful and emotional to go back into that little house, which mostly hasn't been renovated. It's largely the same as it was when Juanita lived there, and just to sort of touch the walls and the staircase, and to, you know, to walk through that house, it's like you could feel her presence in every room. And it's such a small house, and she obviously loved it and the whole street and the community so much, she really gave her life trying to save it.
Now, looking a bit towards the work, stylistically, the video work kind of flows like a documentary a little bit. Can you talk me through why you chose to explore the story in that way?
Yeah, it's halfway between fiction and documentary, and I think both elements help us understand a story. So obviously the people who are still alive, who knew Juanita, who were interviewed, which is the documentary part of the film, gives incredible insight. So David Farrell particularly, because he was her lover for 10 years and was very close to her, and the way that he can talk about her, really no one else could. You know, I think that's a really emotional and significant part of the story. Other fellow travellers like Ian Millis, who was involved in the squat movement, bring incredible insight into the violence and the struggle that was happening around the right to the city in the early to mid-1970s. And Meredith Bergman, who is obviously an expert on the green bands and can really talk about the whole union movement and how that was so significant for Sydney that we know today. So all that part, I think, reveals a certain truth. However, I think if you're going to understand Juanita, there's another truth to reveal, which is that, you know, she was this flamboyant, highly fashionable, highly intelligent, highly unusual and rebellious spirit. And I think the other aspects of the film kind of draw out some of that, so you kind of get a flavour for the, you know, the way she dressed and how she thought about the world and her courageousness, her, you know, her real fearlessness in the face of opposition. Beyond that, also, because Juanita disappeared, I feel like there's a void in the centre of Sydney that, instead of filling it with one actor, I have a casting. So there is there's around about 12 people who auditioned to be Juanita, and each of one of them I chose really carefully for either their, you know, their looks or their characteristic or their activism or where they lived, who all kind of brought out aspects of Juanita's personality. And I feel in a way that stops it being a documentary about the 1970s and it makes it a film about today.
Thinking about the actors in the film, one thing that I really loved is that they read some scripts and then at times they reflected on their connection with Juanita. Was that something that happened organically or was that your intention?
Yes, yeah, so I told them all that we would do an interview with each one of them, and I said, you can prepare a lot or nothing at all, it's up to you. So I was interested in just what they knew about Juanita. And so some knew a lot and had prepared, and some were of her generation, like were older and around when she vanished, so it was very personal for them. And some were completely new to the story and didn't know very much, but obviously knew from their own personal experiences of what it's like to live in Sydney. So I think all that was valid and all of that was interesting.
So there are 1,344 possible variations of the film. Can you explain that to me?
Actually, there's more. There was 1,334 for the Melbourne showing, but we've included an extra file for the Sydney ones, which is an interview with Tyson Coe from Keep Sydney Open, because we couldn't really tell the story of King's Cross without that sort of information, and, you know, that was so relevant for a Sydney audience. So that takes the possible variations up to just over 2,000. People often ask me who killed Juanita and does the Beehive tell us who killed Juanita, and I think it does, but I don't say it straight out. There's lots of clues, so if you watch a few, I think it's very clear who I think did it. But what my focus was on was why her killers got away with it, and I think that's really a bigger question to ask now, particularly as it's not like teacher's pet or anything like that. It's not like that. We can bring the perpetrators to justice because they have all passed away.
That was Zanny Beg there, the artist behind The Beehive, an installation up at the UNSW Galleries in Kofa, just in Paddington off Oxford Street. It is showing as a part of Sydney Festival, like everything else in our show today, busy time of year. So be sure to check that one out. It's free. It's opening today, as I said, and is running until February 23rd. And also, as she said there, there's over 2,000 variations of the film, so you can go back a million times or 2,000 times and see something a little bit different. Right now, I am going to take a track from Courtney Barnett. This is The City Looks Pretty. You are tuned into So Hot Right Now to SCR.
We'll be right back.
that there, one of my favourite Courtney Barnett tracks, The City Looks Pretty. You are tuned into So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of arts and culture. My name is Nicole Beck, and I am with you for just under another half an hour. So the next Sydney Festival event that we are dying to unpack is Masters of Modern Sound. Right, up next, we're going to talk you through this journey of art, meditation, and experimental electronic music. We'll be joined by the executive producer of the project, as well as an artist, Chris Abrams. I'm going to take a track from Chris now. This is off his album out in 2016, Fluid to the Influence. This is 1 liter Cold Laptop. You're tuned into So Hot Right Now to SCR.
Thank you.
You are tuned into So Hot Right Now on 2SER 107.3. That track there, which unfortunately I had to cut off early because time is of the essence today. That was 1 liter cold laptop by one of our guests who's joining us in studio at the moment, Chris Abrams. And so we're here to talk all about Masters of Modern Sound. So the Art Gallery of New South Wales will be opening up their doors to an exquisite after dark experience of art, space and sound. Masters of Modern Sound showcases works from both Australian and international composers and musicians for 3 nights only. So I'm joined by creative producer Jonathan Wilson and pianist Chris Abrams, who are in here with me today to chat all about the event. Welcome, guys.
Hi. Hi.
So, John, as the creative producer of this event, how has it been managing so many musicians and performers to showcase such a playful and experimental idea?
I think it's been fun, to be honest with you. It's been really quite easy, for want of a better word. Everybody seemed to be quite open to the idea of performing in the gallery space and in a different kind of context to what would be a normal sort of gig scenario. And, you know, the music that a lot of the performers and artists that we're working with actually blurs the lines between that kind of contemporary visual space or contemporary art as what it is today, whereas things are kind of, you know, crossing over a lot more than they used to. So it's been good.
Speaking in regards to that crossover, how have you laid out the flow of this work, considering you're, you know, blurring the lines between visual and sound art? So have you integrated performers throughout the gallery or one space?
Yeah, no, they're right across the space, and some people are performing at the same time. There's definitely, we're trying to work towards a kind of sequential thing that you would experience from start to finish. I mean, that said, people can check in whenever they want. Once the actual time slots will be put out next week, just prior to the event. But the idea is that you sort of come in and absorb from start to finish, and it should take you on a bit of a journey across the whole space. But you choose your own adventure. I think, you know, that's a thing, right? Bandersnatch was on the other day. It's all about choose your own adventure at the moment. Anyway, but there's ebbs and flows throughout the evening, and a range of different types of musicians that kind of more inhabit that sort of ambient world.
Great. So it occurs over 4 hours, right? So, and then it's not just sound and the visual art, but you've also collaborated with Force Majeure.
That's right.
How has that collaboration come about and what's involved there?
We were just really interested in working with them and saw a great opportunity for them to be a leading force, for want of a better word, to push people around the space and actually have some alternative interventions that might actually riff off the music that's being performed. So there's three key performers that will be doing a range of different things across the whole night at different points. So you'll be able to, you know, if you're just a dedicated sort of music fan, you'll be able to kind of dig in and just enjoy the music. If you want to see the art, you can actually go and see the art. The whole ground level of the gallery is open, as well as the special exhibition space, which has Masters of Modern Art from the Hermitage in it. And they'll be moving through the space, kind of helping you along with your journey.
Wonderful. Chris, can you talk us through your involvement with the project?
Well, I'll be playing solo piano in a part of the gallery. I think is it the ground floor?
Or it's on the ground floor, yeah.
I'm an improvising musician and, also make experimental albums with for the Room 40 label. Lawrence English is also a performer at this event. So, I'm not exactly totally sure what I'll play, but it'll be something that will be recognisable as me, hopefully.
And I think the interesting point for that is that it's some of the music along with the performance movement artists will be kind of dictated by the people in the space, so it can kind of play from that, you know, dictated by the moment.
So it's a bit of an interaction between a variety of elements. You've got visual art, then the audience themselves, Force Majeure. So I guess you can't really predict how it will go in a way. Is it kind of ambiguous? Do you...
Totally, yeah. and daunting, but you know, exciting that it that there's a space and a platform that's kind of emerging in like galleries like this gallery. It's such a beautiful space, but for things to be slightly experimental and for that kind of edge to be, you know, just happen on that the evening. So it's kind of, it's exciting, it's scary, but it should be totally unique, if anything.
Yeah, definitely. So Chris, we just had a track of yours. Are we gonna hear things more along those lines or the classical kind of style?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say classical,
yeah.
But I've been, you know, playing some solo piano before concerts recently, and I mean, I tend to go for a kind of, there's a certain sort of minimalism, I suppose, that I'll be, possibly a lot of bottom end.
Okay, great.
Low down on the piano. A lot depends on the resonance of the space. The sort of things I do, that's quite it's quite site-specific what I do. So I haven't yet had a chance to play in the space, but before the concert I'll have a good sound check and take it from there.
Do you think you'll draw inspiration from the visual art or more
yeah,
the acoustics?
I think so, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. Dean Hurley, who's worked with David Lynch, is carrying new compositions that respond to the gallery's, the current exhibition, Masters of Modern Art from the Hermitage. How will that work out?
So Dean was here in November. He spent a week inside the gallery. And Dean has a really interesting process. So Dean's the only artist in this exhibition who will be just playback. The rest of them are all live performances in the space. So he has a variety of different spaces set up across the gallery where you can just kind of sit and pause and listen, or there might be things that you cross over the threshold, you'll kind of acknowledge that there's a sonic space happening, and that will be Dean. He's an amazing artist in his own right, but he spent a week in the gallery just capturing sounds. And the way he works is he takes slightly like a millisecond of a recording and finds, he's telling me this, he usually goes to a minor kind of key harmonic structure within that, and then he uses computers and things to manipulate that sonic sound into these kind of rather large, you know, hour-long choral pieces. And what you find, they usually end up sounding like things like, there's a piece that he sent through which sounds just like a choir. It's not. It was pulled from a fire alarm that went off in the gallery.
Wow.
But it sounds like people. So he really manipulates acoustic and field recordings, acoustic sounds and field recordings, into something completely different that it has a resonance of that space. And he talks a lot about being like interested in electricity and the way that kind of moves with sound, which is kind of one of the reasons we brought him into this mix as well. Because a lot of the artists, for example, Caterina Barbieri does a lot of modular synth work, and that stuff is all built on electricity moving through circuits to make the tonality, and that's how you manipulate these things through voltage. So there's loose connections between each of the artists about what they're working on. But Dean, you know, kind of really lucky that he just was really receptive to the idea and had just finished. Last year, he had finished off the Twin Peaks return score for that, and he did the bulk of the music, a lot of the music for that series, which was, again, similar process, the same way he was doing, but he was manipulating sounds out of the actual television show. So all of that sound in the background is coming directly from the show.
Wow. So considering this is quite an original event, what would you like audiences to come away with from their experience?
I don't know. What do you think there, Chris?
Well, I mean, I'd like to think there were, you know, there was a kind of synthesis between the what they heard, what they saw performance-wise, and the artwork. I mean, some kind of, you know, possibly not rational connection that comes together and is, you know, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. That's hopefully... that people, you know, find it, you know, stimulating.
And for me personally, I hope that people, you know, come in with a open mind to what they may experience, be challenged by a bunch of things, also kind of, you know, the hope is they leave blissed out a bit as well with some of the music is particularly, say, Lawrence English and the William Basinski work, their last album. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful. Like, it's one of the most, I think it's one of the best records that I've heard from both of them. I love both their work, but this is, it's just such a beautiful album, and that'll be the final piece for the evening that you'll get to hear. So there's a hope that it kind of comes in with a whole rush of energy and excitement, and you sort of leave somewhat, not to sound too new age, enlightened.
And just lastly, is this something that we might be able to see again, or...
Oh, this is it. There's three nights.
Okay.
And that's it. 8 till midnight, Thursday, Friday,
tickets.
Saturday.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you guys so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. Good luck with everything next weekend.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Wilson and Chris Abrams. They're talking about Sydney Festival's Masters of Modern Sound. It's all going down at the Art Gallery of New South Wales from the 10th to the 12th next week. Buy your tickets. I think it's going to be quite popular. We'll put all the details up on our website, so check it out there. Right now, I'm going to take another track from Only Real. This is Backseat Kisses. You are tuned into So Hot right now.
love the camera as much as we do? Our partners at Head On Photo Festival are calling out for entries across all their competition categories. Anyone with a phone can enter the mobile category, and students from K-12 can enter the student category. And there's a $60,000 prize pool up for grabs. Head On looks for the best professional and up-and-coming photographers and takes place right here in Sydney in May 2019. For more info, head to headon.com.au. 2SER is a media partner of Head On Photo Festival.
Welcome back to So Hot Right Now. I've got just over 5 minutes left with you, and that's just enough time for our very last interview. We are talking all about Black Box, which is happening at the Blacktown Showground Precinct in the heart of Western Sydney. Now, Black Box may sound familiar because it's not the first time we've seen it. It was unveiled earlier last year, at Barangaroo as part of the 2019 Sydney Festival lineup. The work is presented amongst a brand new program entitled Four Winds, which is created by Daniel Browning alongside elders, young people and musicians from Blacktown, which is Australia's most populous urban First Peoples community. On the line now is Daniel to tell us more about the project. Good morning, Daniel.
Hi, Nicole.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
So for those of us who missed Black Box last year at Barangaroo, what can we expect to see in this rendition of the project?
Okay, well, Black Box itself is a rectilinear structure. It's actually physically a box. And inside we program sounds usually related to place. We did that at Barangaroo. What we're doing at Bankstown, though, is we've identified four key artists, four key members of the Western Sydney community. And they are Sean Millwood, who's 17, Savannah Russell, who's 18, Aunty Edna Watson, who's 79, and Uncle Wes Mahn, a very senior elder, he's 96. So basically the idea is an intergenerational dialogue spanning the years, spanning the country, but it's straight, you know, it's really raw, unvarnished storytelling, and it's come straight from the heart of Western Sydney.
Can you talk to me about the collaboration between these people from such different walks of life? How did you find this eclectic group?
Well, we were lucky enough to have a cultural consultant, and that's Lily Shearer. She's one of the principals of Mugglin, a theatre company based in Sydney, at Carriageworks, actually, in inner Sydney. Now, Lil had worked with all four of the artists. She's worked very heavily, very closely with Aunty Edna and Uncle Wes over the years. So Lily was able to identify these four people. So that was part of the really tough thing, I think. It's working out how these people get along and how they communicate and if they're known to each other. That kind of thing is really important because you can hear that in the voice. So their interaction is what you're going to hear inside the box. They have conversations about difficult subjects. They have conversations about things that make you smile. It's a really wide-ranging conversation. And then there are questions that I come in and I ask. I'm not audible, but I certainly was present. I was there when all the dialogues were recorded. But there's some straight questions that I ask about, you know, history and about, you know, the individual lives. I mean, it's really, what it's about is, you know, these four people are the boss of their own story. They don't attempt to try and nationalize their story. It's just like, this is what happened to me. This is my experience. This is what happened to me in my life. So, and it's an incredible journey, I have to say. And I say that as a curator, but it is an amazing journey through our history, through contemporary life, what it means to live in Western Sydney, what it means to be an Aboriginal person in Western Sydney. It's pretty awesome, I reckon.
Yeah, wonderful. One thing that we found particularly interesting is that you, through Black Box, you aim to delve into the idea of deep listening. Can you explain what that means for audiences?
Yeah, well, deep listening, think about it. How often do we actually really focus on what is coming out of the mouth of another person? How often do we just pick apart each word and listen consciously and intently, not just to what people are saying, but to what maybe they're not saying? So it's about nonverbal. It's also about being cognizant of everything that's going on around you. It's just exemplified, say, when you're walking in the bush. You will, if you're really attuned to it, you have to be alert to all the danger. So, imagine an ancestor on a hunt, you know, 500 years ago, 5,000 years ago. They had to be attuned to everything that was going on around. They had to be attuned to what the animals were doing and what they were sensing. To what the earth was doing, or what the planet was doing, what the sky was doing, the wind. So what we've tried to encapsulate is how we all need to be conscious, particularly in this era, of what it means to listen to another person, to hear what's coming from their heart. And sometimes it's not always as simple as what's coming out of their mouth. It's a lot more, it goes a lot deeper than that.
Wonderful. And just quickly before we finish up, what else is involved in the Four Winds project besides Black Box?
Well, we've got commissioned new music. Every time the Black Box is installed, and it is a mobile listening space, it will travel. It's traveling from Barangaroo to Bankstown. We've commissioned a composer and multi-instrumentalist called Eric Avery. He's absolutely fantastic, master violin player.
Sorry.
He's also Matt on the keys. And Emma Donovan is a song woman.
Thank you, fantastic. Daniel. Yeah. Sorry, we're just about out of time.